You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
Thanks, Stephanie. Thanks, Molly, for sharing about our partnerships in Guatemala. It's a good time down there. You should go. You guys had that experience. We've been sitting around on a Saturday and like an old movie comes on that you wouldn't choose to watch, but you just kind of watch it anyway because there it is. Hey, you guys ever had that experience? All right, thank you. Let's just do this. They're not even paying attention over there. This happened to me recently. Jerry Maguire came on. Oh, there you are. And I just wanted to get to the line, you know? So I watched this whole thing to get to the line. All right, there's two kinds of people in here. There are people who think the line is you complete me. That's not what I'm talking about. What's the line, guys? Show me the money. Yeah, because money talks. If you like my guy, show me the money. And you've heard that phrase, money talks, because money does talk. Money is persuasive. It gets you access. It gets you opportunity. Money gets things done in a way that words sometimes don't. I like to play this game with people called what's your price? And so I'll think of something that I know that they wouldn't do, and then I'll just ask them, hey, what's your price to do that thing that you wouldn't do? It's always dumb stuff. So like this week, I asked Todd what his price was to drive a car that was wrapped in like a Providence logo. We never got to, I mean, it's up there, it's high, whatever. It may not exist, I don't know. It may not be talking to him, I don't know. It's always stuff like that, but I have found that there's almost always a price that makes this ridiculous thing feel worth it, and that's because money talks. We see that in James 5. David Gibson points out that money is saying things in this passage. In verse 3, the corruption of gold and silver will testify against the oppressive rich. It will speak against them. In verse 4, he says the unpaid wages are crying out against fraudulent landowners. And so James is talking to people here who are storing up money for themselves because they hear money saying to them, hey, I can make life easy on you someday. I can make you safe and secure. And James is talking to people who are just spending money on themselves and indulgence and luxurious living because money is saying to them, hey, I can make you feel great. Like we can have your best life now. Money talks to all of us about security, pleasure, and comfort, and it talks loud. Sometimes it's hard to hear other voices, and so when James takes up the subject of money, he's going to talk really loud. He has to, or else we wouldn't hear it. Look how he starts. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. It doesn't get any better than that. Like, as the passage goes on, that's the tone. That's the message the whole way through. Weep and howl, miseries are coming upon you. James is taking up the language of the Old Testament prophets. The prophets used dramatic language and images to get people's attention, to wake them up. And James is trying to wake us up. Now, he's not condemning all wealth. We're going to see that. What James is speaking against, what he's doing is like a public prophetic judgment on the oppressive rich. These are people who have gained their wealth unjustly, and they are using their wealth selfishly. That's the primary audience, but, there's always a but. This passage, because he's doing it publicly, he's doing it in a letter to Christians, it's also a warning to us. So maybe the oppressive rich are on the far end of the spectrum, but look, we're not on the other end. We're somewhere in the middle. It's a warning to all of us about our attitudes and our practices related to money. This is a challenging subject for everybody. And James is just saying, hey, don't, like, lean in. Come now. Listen up. Get close. Let's talk about this for real. And the main thing that he's saying is he's giving us a warning about the misuse of money. Money's not bad. Money can be used for tremendous good, but what James is saying, yeah, but it can also be misused. And that's the charge that he's bringing against them in this passage. In verse 3, he says it, you have laid up treasures in the last days. And so I just want to start by talking about that phrase, what that means, and then we'll look briefly at three specific things that James points out, three ways that maybe we have laid up treasures in the last days. So let's start with this phrase, this idea of laying up treasures. You might recognize that language from Jesus. In Matthew 6, Jesus says, hey, don't lay up treasures on earth where moth and rust steal, and decay and thieves break in and steal. Lay up treasures in heaven. Nothing gets stolen there. Nothing decays there. So to lay up is just to accumulate, to gather, to store up. You can lay up treasures in heaven. So any act of faith or obedience, any work of God, anything you do that has eternal value, that's a treasure in heaven. It never fades. It never decays. If that's what you're aiming for in life, laying up treasures in heaven, then money just becomes a means toward that end. You'll use money to honor God, to advance the kingdom of God. And that will be treasure in heaven. Jesus calls this being rich toward God. You can also lay up treasures on earth, which is just to say you can accumulate all kinds of things that are temporary in nature and are fleeting. You won't take them with you. The man who discipled me when I was in college had all these little sayings. One of the sayings he would say all the time is, Will, you'll never see a hearse pulling a U-Haul. And that's so corny, but really good for a college guy to get in my head. That was a great image as I was thinking about what I wanted to give my life to. It's like, you know what? Whatever I accumulate on this earth, like, I won't be taking it with me. Have you ever looked up somebody's net worth on the internet? Do not lie. You've done it. And you've imagined what it would be like to have that kind of net worth. You won't do that in heaven. Like, because it'll be totally irrelevant. What you made, what you had, that won't even be a topic of conversation. It won't matter. You won't take any of it with you. This is the wisdom that Jesus has for us. Money can be used for so much good, but it can also be misused. If you don't use it at all, or if you use it frivolously on yourself, that's a waste. It's a waste of money. It's also a waste of your life. When James says in verse 3, you have laid up treasures, he's talking about treasures on earth. And then he adds this little phrase. He says, you've laid up treasures in the last days. So the early church, this phrase, the last days, for them meant the time, the era, the age between the resurrection of Jesus and the return of Jesus. And those two things, just the reality that Christ had been raised and the certain promise that he's going to return, those two things changed, well, everything about their lives, but specifically changed the way they thought about money and things. You can see it like in Acts for sure. In Acts 4, Luke tells us that the church community said, no one thought of the things that belonged to them as their own. That's a weird phrase. They had things that belonged to them. They had land and property and stuff, but nobody thought of it as belonging to them, as their own, because in their view, everything they had belonged to God and therefore belonged to God's people. And so what you'll see in Acts and throughout the New Testament is there is this, when there are needs that arise, not only in the local church, but churches everywhere, people have this eager readiness to share. They don't even think twice about it. So the last days is marked by radical generosity, but it's marked by another thing. For them, the last days meant that there's a judgment coming soon. It's near. This was front of mind for them. Almost every New Testament letter talks about the judgment day of God. And so they lived with this sense of accountability, the sense of stewardship, that they're going to stand before God and account for their money and things. So radical generosity and an expectation that the judgment is near. That's what marked the last days for them. And so when James says this, he's just pointing out the like tragic irony that it's during this time of generosity and expectant judgment, it's during this time that people have lived so selfishly with their money. It's just ridiculous. He calls out three things, three ways that they've been selfish with their money: hoarding, withholding, and indulging. We're going to talk about each of them pretty briefly. Maybe. We'll see. All right, let's start with hoarding. James 5, verse 2. After he says, "Weep and howl, for the misery is coming upon you," now he gets into it. "Your riches have rotted, and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver have corroded, and their corrosion will be evidence against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You have laid up treasures in the last days." And so they have so much: riches, garments, gold, silver. But I want you to see that the problem here isn't wealth in itself, right? I mean, it's not even that people are saving money. That's okay. The Bible commends prudence and wise planning and taking care of your family and all of that, right? So that's not the issue. The issue here is not saving, it's hoarding. Excessive accumulation of saving. Hoarding is kind of both an act and a belief. It's the act of accumulating things for yourself, keeping things to yourself, keeping all your stuff to you. And the reason people do that is because there's this underlying belief that they've got to secure themselves by their own means. Like, if you think that your security is up to you, then you will save and invest and protect your riches like your life depends on it, because that's functionally what you believe. Security for these people was not tied to, oh, we have a good God who knows what we need and gives generously. It was tied to their net worth. So they're always checking that. James says two things about hoarding. First, it's foolish. He says, "Your riches have rotted and your garments are moth-eaten." So your abundance of possessions, it's subject to decay. In the ancient world, wealth was not like money in banks. It was mostly goods stored up. And so it was vulnerable. A good image might be like spoiled meat. They didn't have freezers, right? So if they had meat, they could only preserve it for so long. So having an abundance of food or an abundance of meat would do you no good, because it's just going to go bad. And James is saying, all riches are like that. It's all fleeting. It will all go away someday. Money says, "I'll make you secure." But that kind of security is subject to rot. So the first thing about hoarding is it's foolish. The second thing is more serious: it'll be evidence against you. Verse 3, "Your gold and silver have corroded, and their corrosion will be evidence against you. They'll testify against you. It will eat your flesh like fire." That's judgment language. So obviously, gold and silver don't corrode. They don't rust. James knows that, knew that. People he's writing to knew that. This is an example of like prophetic hyperbole to make a spiritual point. And the point is that even what you thought was incorruptible has been ruined by your greed. Even what you think is the most enduring wealth will burn up on the day of judgment. Notice he uses the past tense. Your riches have corroded. Your riches have rotted. Your gold and silver have corroded. He's saying that the future day of judgment is so certain. It's so real, so sure that it's as if that thing you have in your hand, that thing you're clinging to, it's already as good as dust. Judgment day will test our treasures. Our treasures on earth will burn up. Our treasures in heaven will last forever. They'll endure. Now, everyone wants to know where the line is. If you have any, this is going to come up in your GC this week. We want to know, okay, wait, when does saving become hoarding? Where's the line? Just tell me the rule. And the Bible doesn't really give you a line, because God gives all of us different things to steward. It's more complex than a rule. And we're meant to work this out in relationship with God and with our community, other people who are seeking God. And to do that, Jesus just gives us a principle. Here's what he says in Matthew 6. He says, don't be anxious about your future. Instead, seek God first. Seek his kingdom. Walk in his ways. Trust that he knows what you need and he'll add whatever you need to your life. And that seeking God first thing is really the key. Because what that means is that in your saving, in your investing, in your planning, you're doing all of it in submission to God. You're laying it all before him. You might even lay it before others who are also seeking him, wise counsel. You put it all out there and you just say, Lord, it all belongs to you, so help me just be a good steward of it. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. When we don't lay it before God, the default is we become very self-focused with our money. One expression of that is hoarding. Another misuse of money that he talks about is withholding. Look at verse 4. Behold, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, are crying out against you, and the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. So not only are they hoarding, keeping stuff for themselves, they're withholding wages due to the workers that they've hired. So he's talking to these wealthy landowners who have hired basically day laborers, and they're not paying them. And it's putting them in a really difficult situation. They need to get paid every day. This was the law of God, Deuteronomy 24. You shall not oppress a hired worker who is poor and needy. You shall give him his wages on the same day before the sun sets, for he is poor and he counts on it, lest he cry against you to the Lord and you be guilty of sin. That's what's happening here. They're just violating blatantly God's law. And they can do that because the poor have no way to defend themselves. They have no recourse. And so James is coming to their defense here, like a prophet would. Not by getting revenge, but by reminding them that judgment day is coming. God is real. Death is real. Judgment is real. That's his reminder. James says that their voices are crying out. He uses the phrase, the Lord of hosts. Right, these are both judgment day type phrases. You see it throughout the Bible. Anytime there's injustice, a cry rises up to the Lord. So, you know, Cain and Abel, Genesis 4, Cain kills his brother Abel, and God comes to Cain, and he says, Cain, the blood of your brother cries out from the ground. I know what you did. In Exodus 3, you know, God's people are enslaved, and they're crying out, and he comes to Moses, and he said, I have seen the afflictions of my people. I have heard their cry. I know their sufferings. James says, that's happening here. Verse 4, the unpaid wages are crying out. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. And that phrase, the Lord of hosts, means like the commander of armies, angelic armies. It's a pretty powerful image. Riches make you feel powerful. Sometimes they give you actual power here. And when you feel that way, you start to kind of feel invincible, like you can do whatever you want. We see examples of this all the time. And what James is saying, maybe you can do whatever you want now. Maybe you get away with your injustice for a while, but the Lord of hosts is coming against you. And then you will be the ones who cannot defend yourselves. That's real. The Psalms basically pray for this. Psalm 72 says, may God defend the cause of the poor. May God deliver the needy. Crush the oppressor. You ever prayed a prayer like that? It's pretty fun. It's pretty fun. If you do it right. This situation that James is talking about is a good opportunity for us just to ask, are there ways in which we're withholding? This is one of those things that you automatically assume you're not doing, and that's usually a sign that maybe you are. Like, do we have debts that we're neglecting or delaying? Do you have employees? Do you have say in what people in your company make, what their wages are? Now, are you being generous? Like, the standard of, you know, sort of doing business is to try to get as much out of people as for as little as you can, and then pocket the profits. And so if you are in a position where you have say in that, you could really stand out in this environment by actually caring about people over profit, being really generous, not just fair, generous. Maybe there's something that you've wanted to do, like God has kind of put something on your heart, some vision on your heart, some project, and the reason you haven't done it, if you're honest, is just because it's gonna cost you, or you don't know exactly what it's gonna cost you. These are all ways that we withhold. And the good news is we don't have to withhold because God hasn't withheld from us. He has freely given us his son. And if he's given his own son, will he not also give us all things, Paul says. Verse 6, he says to the oppressive rich, you have condemned and murdered the righteous person. He does not resist you. Now, this could refer to these workers, the poor, the innocent, the righteous, who are in a really like life and death kind of situation because of withheld wages. That may be. Some people also think this is actually just a reference to Jesus. He is at least the representative of the righteous murdered. Right? Because Jesus is the only one who is truly righteous. Yet he was condemned and murdered by oppressors. It all seemed very backwards because the psalm prays God crushed the oppressor, but instead God crushes his innocent righteous son. He doesn't crush them, they crush him. But then God raises him up so that we can see the whole story. And the whole story is that Jesus gave himself to being crushed so that we could be raised with him in his victory. God raised him up, put all of his enemies underneath his feet. That's our victory in Christ. We don't have to withhold anything. We already have everything. So there's hoarding, there's withholding. Finally, he points out indulgence. Look at verse 5. You have lived on the earth in luxury and in self-indulgence. You fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. So he started with the savers, hoarders, and now he's going to talk to the spenders. That's some of us. Namely, though, people who are spending their money on themselves in like luxurious, self-indulgent ways. In verse 2, he mentions moth-eaten garments. So these people have nice clothes. They have so many clothes. They have clothes for every occasion, every season. They like pack away winter clothes during the summer. And then I just have my clothes. It's just like whatever I have, that's for every season. That's an all-season kind of wardrobe. Some of you are not like that. Some of you really like clothes. Like, you know what's in, and you gotta have it. I'm not into clothes. Like, I like clothes. I'm wearing them, you know. I'm not into it like that. I've been wearing basically the same 5 shirts up here for several years now. So, obviously. But I'll tell you, here's my confession. I'm into shoes, for real. You're judging my shoes right now, aren't you? You guys can get a look. How do you like them? Thanks. I'm getting a lot of thumbs up over there. I'm into shoes, you know? And sometime this week, I will think about buying shoes. I know that because I think about it almost every week. I don't need shoes. I'm done growing. I'm a full-grown man. I could go a long time without buying any more shoes. But sometime this week, I'm gonna get an ad for some cool shoes because the internet knows what I want. And I will see those shoes and I will think about getting them. I probably won't now that I've told you about this, but I will have a moment where I will think, man, I wish I had enough money not to think about this at all, just to get shoes whenever I want. That would be awesome. You see, like, money's talking to me in those moments. Money's saying, hey man, I can make you look good and feel good. That's how you feel good, is you look good. You probably need these. You have a public job. I mean, there's just lots of things will happen. The same could be said of food and drink, travel, hobbies, home improvement, online shopping. These are all ways we indulge. All of these things promise pleasure and beauty, but that kind of pleasure and beauty gets eaten up. The thing about indulgence is it's addictive. So, the more you look to things and experiences to satisfy your soul, the emptier those things and experiences will leave you. And so you'll need more things and experiences. Your luxuries, what you think are luxuries now, will become necessities, and so you'll need new luxuries. We live in an age of just constant upgrades. That's how indulgence has become a way of life for many of us. We may think we're living large, but James says we're just fattening our hearts for slaughter. You get a pig confined to a little sty, and you just overfeed him. You give him so much food, and you make him comfortable, and you pamper him. That pig thinks this is the good life, because he doesn't know what all that's for. And James is saying we're under the same delusion. We think this is the good life. A day is coming. A day is coming. Did you know that God doesn't want you to be satisfied with your life? He wants you to enjoy it. He wants you to enjoy all the good gifts that he's given you, but those gifts are just signposts. They point you to their ultimate fulfillment in God. Only God can satisfy your soul. Again, everyone wants to know where the line is. Okay, when does enjoying good gifts become self-indulgence? How do I know? And again, there is no line. There's a principle. Jesus said, it's better to give than to receive. Which means, if pleasure and joy is what your heart is looking for, you won't ultimately find it in luxuries, you'll find it in generosity. Jesus is not trying to make your life worse. He's trying to make it better. It's better to give than to receive. Here's a fun little experiment. Next time that you want to get something for yourself, not something you need, but just something you want and something that you can afford, get it, but instead get it for somebody else. And just see how that feels. It's going to be hard for me in those shoes. The reason we spend our money on ourselves is because we think it's ours. We earned it. We should get to do what we want with it. This is a private thing. Money is my business. Stay out of my business. Stay in your lane. I'll do my money. You do your money. We'll just all get what we want. We won't talk about it so that we can keep doing that. The truth is, everything we have comes from God. We're just stewards. And so if you think that God has given you all of the stuff that he's given you just for your enjoyment, you have misunderstood the assignment. God blesses us so that we could be a blessing to others. This has always been the story. Adam and Eve were blessed to be a blessing to the whole world. Instead, they saw and they took and they ate. Abraham and Sarah were blessed to be a blessing to the nations. Instead, they took matters into their own hands. Israel was blessed to be a light to the nations, and instead they just conform to all the idols of the surrounding cultures. The whole story of humanity is really one of a misuse of God's good gifts. Instead of using them to honor him, to advance the kingdom, to bless others, we just hoard and withhold and indulge. That's why Jesus came. He succeeded where all of us failed. Jesus was blessed as the beloved son. Paul says he was equal with God, but he didn't consider equality with God a thing to be grasped, a thing to cling to. Instead, he emptied himself. He took on the form of a servant, took on human flesh, became obedient to the point of death on a cross. And in that passage, in Philippians 2, where Paul is talking about that, he talks to the church too. He says, hey, if this means anything to you, then you should follow this example. We should have the same mind to look not only to our own interests, but also to the interests of others. Jesus died for us so that we could live for others. He blessed us so that we could be a blessing. I like to teach this principle to kids sometimes. I'll give them something, and then I'll say, hey, can I have some of that? And they will say, no, it's mine. I'd be like, I gave that to you like a second ago. But that's how kids think. That's just how they think. Have y'all ever seen the cookie rush that happens after church? We put a few cookies out there. It's so cruel. We put a few cookies. They're not even good cookies, but we put them out in the courtyard, and the kids will make a mad dash. They don't know where those cookies came from. They don't even care. It's manna from heaven. They're going to get them. If you do not want to find yourself in the path of a child on the cookie dash, because he doesn't see you, he doesn't care about you. That kid came to church today for that cookie. I was out there one day, and someone forgot to put the cookies out, and I don't know where they are. And I'm not kidding you, there were tears and lament. Kids were in the bushes saying, how long, oh Lord? It's for real. That probably happens to some kid every week because there's just like a limited supply, right? I mean, they can't all get cookies every week. What I would love to see, I've never seen this, but I would love to see it. I would love to see some fast girl get out there and scoop up a bunch of cookies and get over to the side and wait for all the little kids who can't get out there fast enough to share all those cookies with them. If I saw that, I would bring my own supply of cookies to make sure she had enough to do that. And if she gave all those away, I would go to Costco, I would get the huge pack. I would make sure, I would see to it that she could not outgive my supply, because I would just take so much pleasure in that and just watching her generosity in the courtyard with all the heartbroken kids. I'd probably get a little glory for it too, because they would start talking, right? They'd be like, hey, where did all these cookies come from? And she would be like, Pastor Will. And they would sing songs. Pastor Will is the pastor of cookies. We love him. I would love that. That would be so great. Now, if I gave the girl extra cookies and she hoarded them, she kept them all to herself, you know, she thought that maybe a rainy day, I'm going to hide these cookies. Well, that would be a waste, right? Because those cookies are already not good and they're going to get worse. They're just going to get stale. If she ate them all right then to avoid that scenario, that would be awesome for a minute, and then she would feel so sick. Right? Either way, I would stop giving her cookies because she's not being generous with them. And the real tragedy here is that all the children would not know how great of a pastor I am. Right? But if she's giving them away and she keeps giving them away, that would be amazing. I would delight in it. She will discover firsthand that it's better to give than to receive. And everyone will get to enjoy the gifts, and everyone will praise the gift giver. That's the kind of generosity Jesus is calling us to. To be so open-handed, so eager to share, that it points people to the generosity and the kindness of our good dad. Look, I'll be straight with you. We have so many cookies. Just like so many. If your inclination or your tendency is to hoard them, I think James is just saying, hey, start thinking about how you can spend or give out of your savings. That's a category that some of you don't even have. I have friends who literally cashed out their retirement savings to give to the cause of the gospel. I'm not saying everyone should do that. I'm just saying that's a category. I know someone. I know multiple people who've done that. And if you ask them if they regret it, they'll be like, no. I've gotten so much more joy out of seeing the fruit of that than I ever would have out of the money itself. If you're prone toward withholding, start to like just think about how you can value people over profit. If you're prone to indulgence, Look, the next step is just deny yourself little pleasures that you can afford. Just start building that muscle of restraint. And as you build that, then you can begin to think about, what would it look like to live so generously that eventually I actually can't afford some of the luxuries that my friends have? And they would begin to ask me, why aren't you just getting that? And now I have a chance to talk about the goodness of our God. If this sounds like I'm trying to make your life worse, you're still missing it. It's better. It's better to give than to receive. The only way I know how to break the grip, loosen the grip of money in our lives, to shut the voice of money in our lives, is to start giving a lot of it away. It's the only thing I know. And we have the freedom to do so. We have the joy to do so because Jesus has done it for us. When Paul is raising money from the church in Corinth, he says, you can do this because you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you, by his poverty, might become rich, rich toward God. Jesus knew the joy of giving, and he wants to put that joy in us. He wants his joy to be in us so that our joy can be made full. Let's give thanks. Father, we all just admit that money is saying something to us that we're listening to. It's promising us something that we think we can get apart from you, or that we try to get apart from you, and we just confess that. In a moment of clarity, we proclaim that money cannot save us. Money cannot satisfy our souls. Only you can do that. And we ask that you would stir in us a dependence upon you, a joy in giving, that you would make this church a light of generosity in this city so that people might look to you. And we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.